What this meant, therefore, and this is really the second main implication of the triumph of the Pike-Archivist combination, is that victory in battle came to depend on having one of two things. You either needed an awful lot more pikemen and arquebusers than the enemy, or you needed more experienced pike and arquebus units than the enemy. This may seem like a trivial point, but it's really worth stressing that both of these advantages, having more soldiers or more experienced and better trained soldiers, were above all functions of money. Indeed, one of the main attractions of the pikemen and the arquebusier was that they were relatively easy to train. And this is another interesting contrast with the English longbowmen. To be a longbowman, a successful longbowman, required many, many years of practice, perhaps even a lifetime of practice. By contrast, an arquebusier, a gunner, could be hired and trained really in a matter of weeks. And moreover, at least when comparing other kinds of missile weapons, an arquebus was an awful lot cheaper in the 16th century than something like a crossbow. What this means, in other words, and this is an absolutely crucial feature of 16th century warfare, is that from at least the middle of the 16th century forward, the soldier isn't really the expensive member of an exclusive caste, like the medieval cavalryman was, who was drawn from the aristocracy, nor is he a kind of specialized product of special traditions, like the longbowman, who even in England was often drawn from Wales. What was the soldier? He was a commodity. He was cheap, and he was relatively easy to acquire. Now, it is certainly true, as I've mentioned before, that a well-seasoned pikeman or a well-seasoned arquebusier was an awful lot more effective than a simple raw recruit. But by rotating troops through a hierarchy of progressively more challenging assignments, you could easily gain the advantages of experience. And this process of rotating troops through assignments was actually perfected in the Spanish Army of Flanders. Typically, troops would be recruited in Spain itself, usually in Castile rather than Aragon, and then they would be started off in the easier assignments, the sort of more laid-back Spanish outposts in the southern Mediterranean, maybe in Sicily or in southern Italy. You know, the weather's good there, there aren't too many dangers. And then gradually, after they'd been with the army for a while, they'd be rotated to northern Italy, and then finally over the Alps into the Netherlands. The sum effect of all of these changes, therefore, was that over the 16th century, European armies become an awful lot larger. The simple number of men under arms, the simple number of men on the battlefield goes up dramatically. And put together with all the various changes in weaponry and the changes in organization, historians usually refer to this transformation of warfare as the Military Revolution. There is, however, an important qualification that I think we need to make to the seeming modernization, this sort of rationalization and commodification of the process of fighting a war. And that is, an early modern general is not simply a strategist or a tactician. He's also often an entrepreneur who himself actually would contract to raise a particular number of troops for one of the crown heads for a particular sum of money at a particular time. And the general often expected to profit from the process as well. It wasn't a matter of the general just occupying himself with the battles and the sieges and the money and the pay of the troops coming in, by some central government paymaster. The commander himself was often in charge of the money, and there were all kinds of opportunities for padding the muster rolls or paying the troops a little bit less or charging them for this, that, or the other and making a profit out of the whole thing. There's a sense, in other words, in which the 16th century and the 17th century military unit is really a kind of property, and there actually are instances of them being handed down from a general to his son. The general is not only an entrepreneur, he often has an almost free agent-like character. And what we're going to see in subsequent lectures about the 30 Years' War in particular is that these free-acting generals often became real political problems. Having talked an awful lot about battlefields, I'd also like to talk about sieges as well, because sieges were often more characteristic of warfare in early modern Europe than the field battle, and the 16th century, also in siege warfare, saw a number of crucial technological changes. The first of these was a shift in the way that cannons themselves were made. The shift was from a kind of composite cannon, which was made by binding together different wrought iron bars, to a kind of one-piece cannon made by casting in bronze. And interestingly enough, the technology was often borrowed from bell makers. So you have people who are trained to make to cast bells to ring in churches who then find themselves making cannons instead. It's an interesting kind of change in vocation, although very good cannon makers were in enormous demand, and the best of them worked all over Europe. When the Turks besieged Byzantium in 1453, their gun makers were imported from Hungary. The second main technical change in European artillery was just the cannonballs themselves. It seems trivial, but they were shifted from being made out of stone to now being cast in iron.